Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Piancy, and I am here, as usual, with my partner in crime, Bennett Tomlin. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing well, Cass. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. Today, we are talking about how stablecoins affect forks of other cryptocurrencies. So I'll let you take the reins on this one. You can go ahead and start us off. I know that we are going to be talking about, firstly, how the Tether hack altered Omni. Omni is the first blockchain protocol that Tether was on, and it was forked after the Tether hack. So go ahead and tell us that story.
Yeah, and that story is a really important story because I think it really leads into the whole point I'm trying to get at here. So in November of 2017, the Tether treasury was hacked and just over 30 million Tethers were withdrawn. In response to this, Tether decided to issue a new version of the Omni client to the various exchanges and stuff that accepted Tether. When they started using this client, it effectively froze the Tethers that had been stolen from the wallet and made it so they could no longer be transferred or moved. This change was actually a consensus-breaking change that Tether introduced into the Omni layer. And instead of going through the normal like development process, going through the normal improvement suggestion process, they made this change quickly to the generic Omni client, sent it over to the exchanges and had them start running it, kicking the Omni reference client out of consensus and off the economic majority for the network. My thesis, my belief, is that as stablecoins have become increasingly important, and more things are dependent on stablecoins like MakerDAO and DeFi protocols, the greater the power stablecoin issuers effectively have over governance of the cryptocurrency, because they get to effectively choose which fork will retain the value of the stablecoins.
I think your hypothesis might be true, but I do want to point out that Omni and Tether had both had Craig Sellers working alongside the foundations or the companies. And so it would also make sense to me that Omni ends up forking when, not just because Tether is the dominant coin, but also because the team members are very similar.
Sure, but I think it's telling that they didn't introduce this change into the reference client, right? Into the version of Omni being distributed by the Omni Foundation was for a period not in sync with the version of Omni that was being run by exchanges. And the reason for this is because Tether decided that the consensus rules for what is permissible on the Omni layer should change. And they arbitrarily made that change without going through any governance property and hard forked the network.
And you suspect that that could still be possible even with bigger chains today?
Yes. And so let's look at like Ethereum, for example, right? A lot of the, let's look at USDC because it's commonly used on there and is deeply integrated into a lot of DeFi protocols. In the case where there's some kind of schism in the Ethereum community or whatever that suggests there's a risk of a community changing fork, like Ethereum and Ethereum Classic, or Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash, where you're seeing a substantial part leave because of some difference in opinion over direction. The stablecoin issuers can only recognize the value of their tokens on one chain, right? Because otherwise they end up having too many liabilities for the amount of assets they have. And so their ability to make that choice and the fact that any exchange that wants to accept that stablecoin needs to maintain the infrastructure to support that choice ends up giving them a lot of power. And this gets compounded when you consider how these stablecoins are used. So like MakerDAO is heavily collateralized by USDC, one of these stablecoins. So the MakerDAO team needs to, their coin will only effectively have value on whichever chain that the Circle team says is the legitimate chain. And then consider protocols like Alchemix that are dependent on MakerDAO. Their tokens, their protocol, their stuff will only have value on the chain that MakerDAO follows too. And so a lot of DeFi and a lot of these things have been built up with this idea of modularity, that each of these components should fit together. And in doing so, you can build the system on top of it. But what that does is it gives the foundational pieces, like these centrally issued stablecoins, this extraordinary amount of power over the chain as a whole.
But I wonder if some of the implementation of like Tether on Ethereum now and USDC also is that they have this smart contract that they can manipulate and utilize in ways that they see fit without necessarily having to alter Ethereum at all, right?
Yeah, and that's why I did a little subtle rhetorical trick there where I switched from the example of Tether forcing a hard fork of the Omni network to a separate example where there's like a possible community schism and basically the choice of the stablecoin issuer can severely weaken one of the chains before the fork even occurs, right? So when you're coming up on like some governance issue, like we were in Ethereum or Ethereum Classic or in the big block size debate for Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash, where there's disagreement in the community, whichever side the stablecoin issuer chooses is going to preserve so much more of the value.
And I'm sure some people will disagree with this or adamantly agree with it, but I suspect that a lot of our Bcash friends are of the mind that Tether played a role, and Tether and Bitfinex together and exchanges outside of those two played a huge role in the block size debate. And because of Tether and Bitfinex and their executives and what they wanted, that decision was made, and it was made in BTC's favor. I'm coming into this asking questions because I'm not pretending I'm an expert. So I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about that.
I think that gets at another point that kind of connects here, and that's that whichever coin keeps the ticker often keeps a lot of the marketing community, whatever energy behind it. So in like the block size debate, there were moments and there were some exchanges where there was legitimate debate, or at least it seemed that way from where I was sitting on Twitter, about whether or not which fork would end up getting the ticker at all these exchanges, which would be called BTC. That choice by itself has a lot of impact just because of the mind share associated with like effectively the brand of BTC. And this is where we get into before, where I was talking about how because the exchanges need to run certain infrastructure, need to maintain certain nodes in order to accept the stable coins, right? They might be more likely than to give that ticker to the stuff they already have to be set up to handle. And so you start to get into these situations where in the cases of these forks, these potential community schisms, you see these centralized entities having so much power over the community split.
I've never thought about forks this way. So, and maybe someone else has. Let me know if I'm way out of turn here or if someone else has said it long before and it makes sense. But I never thought of forks as like a conglomerate breaking up. And I think that is on my mind right now because we have GE splitting up. And we have Johnson & Johnson splitting up. And historically speaking, as a matter of fact, when I've looked at some other companies that have ended up having to do similar things, it isn't necessarily the company that keeps the ticker that does indefinitely better. Do you think that there's any comparison there? Do you think that that makes sense in any way? Or is it not at all applicable?
So I think this kind of connects back to a lot of our discussion with Oliver, right? When we were discussing the structure of these networks and what feeds into like breaking apart these communities or feeding into these communities. Because the value of these currencies is so dependent on their ability to attract new interest, to ensure there's people interested in them, I think that it is generally beneficial to, at the point of split, to be seen as the older, more established, one that has persisted over the period, the one that can show the price history dating back to the beginning, right? And so I think providing that extra boost to basically the network effect to feed that flywheel at the beginning will generally cause a pretty strong separation in favor of the one that gets the ticker. This is not necessarily true. For example, you can imagine like in the Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash fork, if early on it had turned out that Craig Wright wasn't lying out his ass and there was some SegWit-breaking bug that was going to ruin the BTC chain in just a couple months, then that would have perhaps changed how the dynamics played out after that point. But I think generally, structurally, keeping that brand, keeping that ticker is going to benefit the token.
But just quickly back to the point of the forks and conglomerates splitting up right now. For GE or for Johnson & Johnson, you have these companies that were built up over like 100 years and were acquiring a bunch of different, maybe you could say, well, I don't know what you say, vertical integration. I don't know what it's called, where you're trying to like have every aspect of some markets and you're also trying to be able to, you know, send yourself stuff for the medical supplies that you're making. And I don't know. I like, at the same time, it makes sense to me that they're going to be splitting up now and that some of them will obviously do better than others, right? And likely, based on stocks historically, I presume that it means it boils down to like some sort of fundamental value, right? Like there's some sort of something there. And I'm wondering if we look at these coins where like, yeah, clearly there's block size and that's the most famous war that has happened. But I wonder if what we're going to see in the future and down the line is just splits based on this factor shouldn't play a role in this cryptocurrency. Let's take it out and put it onto its own separate chain.
So there's a couple different things in that I think are interesting. One, I think part of the issue is the comparison to companies is somewhat imprecise because like with a company, you've got these assets, you've got these liabilities, you've got this productive capacity that's spread out through all these different like sub-entities and stuff, and that's where the value is deriving from. And like you talked about the case of Johnson & Johnson, and part of the reason they're splitting up, right, is because they have this massive lawsuit liability because of all the cancer they caused. And so to help avoid that cancer liability is part of the reason they're splitting this up, to put that burden mostly on one company while they can put the productive assets in another. I think for a lot of these cryptocurrencies, there isn't the same kind of fundamental value that you alluded to as there are for these corporations. And the value is more often derived from the community interested in purchasing and using it and attracting developers and stuff who want to continue to improve and work on these things. And so I think because the value is coming from maintaining the community, feeding that network effect is going to have an outsized effect there compared to in stocks or in corporations.
Right. And that, I guess that bleeds back into what your original point was, which is this indeed could be why stablecoins play such a role in how these forks work out. It could entirely depend on these stablecoins, because when it comes to fundamentals, probably one of the most important fundamentals of any of these cryptocurrencies is just liquidity.
Exactly. Exactly. And so because the decision was made, not even necessarily consciously, because people put these centralized issuers as such a foundational aspect of the economic value that's happening on these chains, in doing so, they made these companies with assets and liabilities and regulations and things they need to deal with, made them one of the primary drivers of the governance of what's supposed to be these censorship-resilient anti-state technologies, basically. And so I think that dynamic has made it so, I think it is unlikely we see another fork quite like the Ethereum Classic fork or the block size fork, where there is like a significant period in question where it's unclear which one's going to be the victor. I think related to that, one of the dynamics that's been interesting to me since basically 2017 is we've seen, I think, fewer and fewer major forks off from the top projects. And more often we've seen like brand new chains being launched that are different in some way. And I'm curious if part of that dynamic is because it was easy early on to fork Bitcoin because it was mostly just simple transactions between people sending value. The more complex it gets, the more modular it gets, and the more layers there are built on top of it, the more difficult it becomes to capture any of that value by simply copying it.
It's interesting that you brought up Ethereum Classic, because I hate to say this, but I've kind of completely forgotten about it.
You don't need to hate to say it. It's a nothing coin.
But, well, interestingly, it has like 1/20th the trading volume of Ethereum, and it still exists, and it's still like compared to genuine like meme coins that exist briefly and then disappear, it doesn't seem to have that. Do you think that there is a point to be made that like forks form communities, and those communities can last for a very long time and they can be very devoted, and that even without the support of like a stable coin and a liquidity provider, that they could, I don't know, genuinely trend upwards. And not that we're seeing that with any of these. Ethereum Classic and BCH and BSV have all done far worse than the originals. But are there any examples of that, of them actually working better than their parent?
I'm going to avoid that question better, because some of our friends might have thoughts on the appropriate answer to that question.
Sorry, I meant price appreciation wise, because speculation is the main thing that matters in this
exactly.
space.
So yes, I think it's possible that one could eventually outperform. And this is why I thought our conversation with Oliver was so important, because it really got into some of those things that can contribute to that. And I thought one of the most striking things that we discussed as like the differentiator that keeps the network effect from being winner take all is the fact that often these communities form around like a specific goal orientation where they're focused on something uniquely. And so I can imagine scenarios where someone forks away from a chain for whatever reason. They think their goal is more valuable. And over time, there is some event that makes it clear to the market more broadly that that goal was the appropriate one to orient towards. And in that case, it is conceivable to me that value and interest would then flow towards that one. And eventually that network effect would overcome the initial advantage given to the chosen chain. I think, though, it's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do, because many of the people participating in the cryptocurrency ecosystem aren't particularly interested in the goals of the different communities, and as you mentioned, are primarily here for speculation. And so that is a difficult fact to overcome.
I also think a difficult fact to overcome is just simply that even when it comes to a good friend of mine pointed out that even when it comes to something as, you know, quote, basic as like stocks, most people don't understand very much about stocks. And I don't mean this in like a negative connotation. I just mean that like the concept isn't super important to most people. And I think that's okay. Like, it's finance, it's complex. And if you're going to be trading stocks on your own, it's going to require a lot of your time and attention. And like, I think it's okay that not everyone wants to devote themselves to that. But I do think that it's funny that a lot of blockchain advocates, cryptocurrency advocates, whatever you want to call them, think that everyone wants to be as dedicated and involved in like the nuance and intricacies of cryptocurrencies as they are. Because I just don't think that that's true at all.
What's also striking to me in that same vein is how many quote unquote blockchain advocates seem to themselves not even necessarily be super interested in the way these functions and like what are the meaningful differences in decentralization between Avalanche and Solana and Ethereum. Right? Like, those aren't questions that necessarily a lot of the people who consider themselves deep into cryptocurrency even ask themselves. Because, as we've mentioned, I think repeatedly at this point, speculation and the desire to earn money is what's driving a lot of that interest.
Right. What other points would you like to kind of draw on to reaffirm your hypothesis, but also hopefully give people who are active in the space something to think about when it comes to this?
I think things like this are why I got like so frustrated when I first looked at multi-collateral DAI and various decentralized finance protocols like that, is because there's the potential in many of these ideas to create meaningfully new things, things that could reasonably be called censorship resistant and allow for transactions outside of the control of any central parties. But design decisions often focused on trying to accelerate the growth of these protocols have resulted in so many of them being deeply dependent on these companies that are antithetical to the entire ethos of the cryptocurrency space. The entire Ethereum smart contract ecosystem is really dependent on Circle and Coinbase, two extraordinarily centralized companies at the beck and call of the US government. And that is a state of affairs that many people seem unfortunately comfortable with.
That reminds me of one of our episodes We specifically were discussing wash trading, which if anyone is unfamiliar with what wash trading is, it's basically if I'm the buyer and seller of an asset and I'm trading it between myself, there is no other individual involved, and I can do that to stabilize the price. I can do it to increase the price. I can do it to decrease the price. I can do it however I want to, really, because I'm the only one trading the asset. But one of the points that we made was that some exchanges report these kind of incredible volume metrics on these stablecoins. And to be fair, it's not only Tether. I assume now Circle does some pretty crazy volume as well. I haven't checked recently. But
much
usually,
less than Tether. Because so USDC has been way more adopted in the smart contract ecosystems, but there's way fewer exchanges with it as like a base trading pair.
You're absolutely right. We talked about the velocity of money, and I don't remember why we were talking about the velocity of money, but the velocity of money, again, here you go, if you're unfamiliar with it, is the amount of times a single unit of the money is exchanged between hands in a certain amount of time. And Tether is exchanged way more than any other stablecoin. It has the highest velocity of money I think I've ever seen. And it used to be even higher. But regardless, that's because of wash trading. And this wash trading gets reported. And I just wonder, like, so why? Why is there wash trading? If some exchanges are taking that out and not counting it as actual trades, then why is it happening at all?
Well, because other exchanges aren't taking it out and are counting it as actual trades.
Yeah, but to that point, saying it clearly is actually an important part of the ecosystem, just like stablecoins. As much as cryptocurrencies want to tell themselves that they're divorced from the U.S. dollar and from fiat, like, it's funny how stablecoins end up being the arguably most important part of the ecosystem.
Yeah, and this is just another striking example to me of the frame we've had to hammer in so many times, that stablecoins are way more important than their market cap may at first make you think. These are the foundation of liquidity across the ecosystem. These have an exorbitant amount of influence over the governance, not just of like the base layers like Ethereum and Bitcoin, but of any protocol that uses these in any way. And the way people treat them as if they're some small feature of the cryptocurrency ecosystem does not align with the reality and the influence they have.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair point to end on. I think I'll try throwing a poll out there this week and see how many people agree with you and your hypothesis. I don't even know when we're going to be recording our next episode. We're going to try to get one more episode out to you guys. Oof, man, it's going to get dicey here in the next couple of weeks while we enter into the holiday spirit. We'll be recording a couple more episodes soon, and I'll make sure that we abide, all right?